Hey, welcome to Code Chat. We are here in the Maker Garage space at Microsoft. It's kind of a fun setting, so I decided to go ahead and do the Code Chat here. As you probably notice, I'm back to the GoPro, using the GoPro for recording. I have a lot of fun with this thing. I know it's made for extreme mountain biking, but it works just as well for
extreme place. So maybe not utilizing it to its full extreme features, but
yeah, there's not necessarily G forces on the camera at this point.
It does look like the kind of places that sparks might fly any moment, though.
Unless by G force we're meaning geek force.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of geek
force graphics cards. Yeah. Point to NVIDIA there.
Yeah, so you see all kinds of tools and electronics and stuff behind me, soldering irons, and it's a geek stream come true. Lots of fun stuff in here. And I'm just in the space working today doing some 3D printing and some laser cutting. Actually waiting in line, there's a guy here laser cutting a pumpkin. What do you think about that?
That's a good way to carve it in the future. So I spent hours and go this. Okay, print.
Actually, he's been here for hours.
In the future. I can imagine your press button done. But, you know, it's prototyping of that.
I think he's actually having to slowly do it with a raster technique, because otherwise he's going to blast through the front of the pumpkin and right out the back of the pumpkin.
Oh, so he wants to, like, have that, like, subtle shading detail, like a little thin cut or something.
Yep. He's got various
probably
shades.
A lot easier if he's just, like, line.
Yeah, it sure would. And I think if he turns it on too hot, he actually makes pumpkin pie on accident. So
that sounds good. It doesn't really do the 3D food printers. It's like everyone talks about the future. Fast food restaurants are all going to be robots.
Seems like it'd work. You could just put some sort of a paste in your 3D printer.
Something about there's like some big prize for that right now.
Yeah?
I made this up, but I felt like it was like some talk that there was like a reward for that because there's so many fast food companies who'd be really interested in developing that.
I'll see if I can find a link to that. I'll include it.
I know there's like a good pizza generator now. There's actually pizza vending machines.
Wow.
That I think, what was it? It's not Italy. I forgot what country they're in right now, but you can actually find them on the street where you say, print me a pizza, and it will make dough, lay it out, do the toppings, speed bake it, and within 15 minutes you have a pizza.
Have you seen the guy that made a paper airplane gun?
No, I haven't.
He actually put a ream of paper in the back of the machine, and it will take a piece off the top, fold it, and fire it out the front. And I think it was like 20 per minute, 20 planes per minute, PPM.
How big is this machine?
It's maybe this wide and
it's 4 feet
long. Yeah. It's pretty impressive.
That's awesome. That is very awesome.
But we're not here to talk about Maker stuff right now, unfortunately. There's all kinds of cool Maker stuff, but we're here to talk about games, because that's kind of the niche that you're in, right?
Yeah, that's my thing.
And by the way, who are you?
I'm Tobias Marks. I am a game evangelist at Microsoft, so we're on the same team.
Same team,
but
calling
I'm down south in Silicon Valley, kind of a popular area for tech.
Yeah, there's a bit of tech going on down there. Right away, how do the folks watching Code Chat find you?
They can go to tobiamarks.com. That's TobiamarkS.com, or follow me on Twitter at tobiamarks.
Awesome. And you talk, I'm assuming, mostly about gaming.
Yeah, gaming is my passion. It's been my whole life. Just a little history about me.
Yeah.
I always wanted to make games. I went to school to make games, got 2 bachelor's degrees in making games. I graduated late 2008, early 2009. And I thought, well, getting a job is going to be hard. So me and a friend we thought, why don't we start our own company? Go through that whole process. Actually release something on, you know, some stores. And then we'll have industry experience, and we'll get a leg up, and we actually want to apply for a real job.
Mm-hmm.
This was early 2009, and we decided to make mobile games on iPhone, which turned out was to be a really good time to make a mobile game company, right when the mobile scene started exploding. So we were on Android right when it came out, we were on Windows Phone right when it came out, Kindle, Nook, the Toys R Us NIMBY tablet.
Wow,
We had games.
How about
on
Game Boy?
We never actually released on Nintendo. Maybe in the future,
All right.
But I still actually have the company on my side. Microsoft has a really good money policy.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up doing that company for 4+ years until I went to Microsoft full-time as an evangelist, which is a big change to go from working for myself my whole life to working for one of the largest tech companies. But I've been having nonstop fun because I love talking. and talking about code, being able to dive into the latest and greatest stuff, being able to try out new stuff, demo new things for people. It's like all the fun parts about tech. And, you know, if I had a real job, you know, not, no offense to anyone with a real job out there, you're sitting working on one thing for 18 months plus, but I'm the kind of person that likes always trying new things, always being able to jump into new stuff.
Yeah. So you're working on games now. Are you working on any you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I have one project in the works that's kind of started. I'm really into physical games.
Okay.
You know Johann Sebastian Joust?
No.
It's this game that got really popular in indie game circles. If you go to GDC, you'll see little pockets of it break out every now and then.
Okay.
And it was started off with just Move controllers on a PC, like it ignored PlayStation. And it was, you know, have the, all the glowing orb on the end.
Mm-hmm.
And if you move it too fast, it turns red. And the goal is to be the last person where it turns red. So, you ever read Doom?
No, classic sci-fi book? I actually didn't. No, I'm not geeky.
Well, okay. So,
my geek
even
there.
More nerd explanation here. You know how, you don't know, but in Doom, they have these like personal shields. And they made so that if someone were to shoot you with a gun or stab you, it would like stop the knife.
Okay.
But this doesn't stop violent crime, because there's just a new form of martial arts. It's all about slow movement and paralyzing your opponent so that you can stab them slowly.
Okay.
So Johann Sebastian Joust is playing with a whole bunch of people, all holding him, moving around slowly and trying to whack the controller out of other people's arms without moving theirs fast enough to get damage. So it's just these people running around slow motion.
So they look weird from the outside.
It looks really weird. You just see a bunch of people like protecting this controller and trying to slap everybody else. So I've been really into proximity devices. I've been messing around with Windows Phone Fantasy a lot lately, just trying to come up with cool ideas on games based on physically touching things.
Mm-hmm.
And I know like NFCs, it hasn't really taken off. I'm hoping it'll get more and more as more and more people, as, you know, has growth, more devices have it, more places have it.
Yeah.
But I think this is a really cool technology that there's a lot to explore with physically touching things. Like, augmented reality is one thing, but I like actual reality.
Yeah, right.
But
I like
integrating
actual
some
reality
tech
too.
Yeah.
You know, actually, our team, when we have meetings, we end up using the NFC on our phones a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because when somebody takes a video, then you can just tap it and transfer it to the other person, no problem. And that's like a really great use case. You know, we use it all the time.
It, like when it works, it's super simple.
Perfect.
And it's great.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of getting more people to have a reason to turn it on.
Yeah.
And gaming is one of those things that drives platforms.
Sure.
Period. No matter what the platform is, drives tech. You know, desktop gaming, you wouldn't be running as fast a machine as you have now. It wasn't the fact that gaming pushed people to buy better computers.
Yep. Somebody needed a crazy graphics card.
So
and now I take it
as awesome as that video sharing thing is, it's not going to keep people turning NFC on their phone constantly. But if there's a game that you can constantly play with that, if there's more games that are starting to break into that physical realm, I don't know, that's just one aspect, right? It's not all of what I do or what I care about, but that's... that's part of what I've been thinking about lately for my projects.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I've been going since I've been working at Microsoft, you know, doing it on the side. I've been focusing less on Blast Monkeys, which is my big game before that I've worked on for like 3 years. But now I'm thinking about these kind of side projects of games as art. What's the next thing? What's experimental? What's cool?
Okay. So your big game right now that you already have is Blast Monkeys?
Yeah, so Blast Monkeys came out originally in the beginning of 2011, I think.
Okay.
And it started off as a two-day game jam.
Mm-hmm.
This is a prototype. We made it and we thought, well, this is actually pretty good. So we'll release it on the store and we'll start iterating on it. We'll start adding new levels. We'll start adding more content. And more people liked it, so we started adding more stuff to it and polishing up and tweaking the art. And by about 5 months in, we were the number one game on Android.
Wow, that's impressive.
First year, we got 12 million or so downloads, and then I made the conscious choice to not care about downloads ever again because I look at it every day and cared about it. Like, wait, what's with today? Why is it less? It's just like, I'll look at general trends, but I don't care about. I have no idea how many people currently have it downloaded. Actually, still lots of people have it and play it today, which is weird because since I got the job at Microsoft, we haven't actually updated in a while, sadly. But
what is it about Blast Monkeys that you think is the reason why people like it?
A lot of people ask me that. It's like the number one question I get.
Mm.
And the funny answer I like to throw back at them is eat right and exercise. How do you lose weight? It's a $1 billion industry. Diet books, people selling exercise equipment, personal trainers, $1 billion industry, how to lose weight. Everyone knows.
Everyone knows weight. The answer.
You just go running, eat less sandwiches. Yeah. So how does an app make number one? There isn't one trick or, oh, if you follow these steps or if you don't do these things, this is what makes it number one. But it doesn't mean it's luck either. You just have to make a game that's fun, engaging. Mm-hmm. People like playing it. People like telling other people about it. And there's a bunch of steps that you can do to make that better, but none of which are secret. Mm-hmm. You know, you can kind of tell what is going to work and what isn't just by getting it in front of other people. I guess that's actually a good point right there, is getting in front of other people.
Is Blast Monkeys one of those games that I have a hard time putting down? Like, is it addictive? Is it want to keep going?
That's kind of the idea about it. It's actually core to our monetization structure for it. So in the free version of the game, which are the most popular versions, you have to pay in-game coin to unlock the next level.
Okay.
So if you get perfect scores in the game, you get, 120% the coin you need to unlock the next level.
Okay.
So plenty. But obviously, people don't get perfect scores the first time they play through. Mm-hmm. So if they want to unlock the new content right away, and they don't want to wait to have to replay levels, then they get an option to do in-app purchases with us.
And okay.
That's how we made the majority of the money.
Okay.
That and advertising.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So that's the game you've got. You've got some other ones in the works. What do you think the landscape looks like right now for the beginner or completely inexperienced game developers, the folks that are interested in breaking into this field?
It is a crazy good time to get into the games industry.
Yeah?
And it's kind of hard to realize how good it is compared to what it was just, you know, a few years ago. When I was starting college, I started in 2005. I know, I'm young. Back then, if I said indie game, this was like a student project, a side thing
that
you would release for fun, maybe. It wasn't something that you could possibly do full-time. Or if you did do it full-time, it was kind of like the indie industry in the movies, where an indie film would then get picked up by a big company and then would be famous and then would make money.
Right.
But now, you can make a product and release it and go to millions of people in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
On any platform, all the major platforms now have digital distribution. All of them have ways for indies to get on their platform. It's a completely open marketplace. And this has just made so many cool ideas coming out, and so many companies from, you know, small 1-2-man teams to even just a moderate-sized 50-person company that would not be able to get the funding before to talk to a publisher and get the distribution and print a disc and be on the Best Buy shelf. Now they can make games and make millions and millions of dollars in many cases.
Can one guy do it?
All the time. I mean, everyone likes to point to Notch, right?
Yeah.
The terms of, like, what person to amount of millions, the Notch story is going to be hard to beat.
Yeah, sure.
Because Microsoft just bought Mojang for,
I don't remember the number.
It was over $2
billion. Yeah,
very large sum of money.
Yeah.
Which I believe Notch got a large percentage of it. Those are numbers behind the screens. I have no information on that. But no, it's not a unique story either. There's a lot of small developers. Oftentimes it's actually 2-3-person teams, because I think it's actually more helpful to work with a friend.
Right.
But there's definitely a lot of cases of solo.
And there's a bit of a broad skill set. I mean, you've got to have a guy that knows how to program and actually develop the application. But then you've got graphics, you've got business, you've got marketing.
That's a great point, because the reason why I'm actually here today is that I was recording the Microsoft Virtual Academy on game production basics. And so me and Amanda Lane, another evangelist from back east, we talked about what do you
now mean? Wait, I don't think folks have the context. So what you're saying is the reason why you're here in the Pacific Northwest is
Seattle. Yes,
Where do you live?
I live in Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley,
so
okay.
So I live south of where we are now in Seattle.
Okay, and the reason you're here?
Was to record this Microsoft Virtual Academy, which is online learning that we have with Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recorded this 3-hour talk on the basics of game production and what you actually need to make a game. So from the basic tools that you can use, how do you organize your team, how can you find different art assets, how can you find different team members, exactly what makes like a 3D asset, you know, what is a texture, how does one unwrap that if people have never worked in a 3D space before. And so the reason why I thought you probably brought it up is that We talked about the different roles, and we kind of boil it down to three main categories: designer, developer, and artist.
Okay.
So artist is a person who does all of the stuff that you interact with and stuff that you see. So all the visual art, 2D, 3D, and musicians, the sound. Those are the assets that make the game. You need that because otherwise your game doesn't have any interface between it and the computer.
Mm-hmm.
The developer is the person who programs it, makes it comes alive, puts everything together. But then there's also the designer who comes up with the game, the plan. It's
okay.
Just a nameless, okay, I'm walking down the screen, I'm in a room and not doing anything. They come up with what makes the game fun. They kind of write out the plan that the developer and the artist then execute. And so the number one game design tool out there, do you know this actually?
Well, I can
pop
guess.
Pop quiz for you.
The number one game design
tool. This is AAA in the number one tool. I have asked many, many professionals this. If you ask them what's the number one designer tool, they will all agree that it's this software or a software that does something similar.
Okay, so you're talking about the visual design.
Now I'm talking about as a game designer, not artist, not visual design, just the game designer, the person who plans out what the game's going to be.
I don't know.
To be clear, we make it as Microsoft. Excel.
I still don't know. Excel.
Spreadsheets are the number one tool of the design.
Yeah, I was going to say it feels like business. I mean, it really is business, right?
It's not just the business aspect, but you're taking an idea in your head and you're trying to communicate it so that other people can come together and make it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of production mixed into it, but it's figuring out the numbers. You've got the mathematical formulas, like how often does this coin drop from that enemy? When you press this button, does it go there, does it go there? You know, work out a Word document, you know, that's also really common too.
Mm-hmm.
But having that kind of open template of a spreadsheet where you can put things in different cells, you know, like they didn't have OneNote back in the day.
Sure, yeah.
So Excel kind of became the default standard of game design.
Interesting.
Number one tool.
That's an interesting factoid. Okay, so I think by the time this episode of Code Chat releases, your MVA will probably be live.
Mm-hmm.
So a person can go to mva.ms and they can search for what? What's the title of your
game course? Production Basics.
Okay.
You can also go back to my blog, tobiamarks.com. We'll have a link to it.
Okay.
A few months ago, I also did another MVA on a 2D and 3D game development using Unity,
okay,
which is a really common game engine. It's now really popular. I highly recommend it. It's a really awesome tool.
Okay.
So I also have that people can check out.
Okay, good. Is that kind of for beginners as well?
Yes, it is designed for people who've never touched Unity before.
Excellent.
No experience. You probably want to have some general idea of code because you will have to touch some C# script, but it's definitely designed for beginner people.
So what do you think about Unity? Do you feel like Unity is a good skill for the aspiring game developer to just start down? Is it a good road to start down?
Well, it's another reason why indies have exploded. This isn't just the availability of customers. That's just one aspect. The tools are better than ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you used to be able to make an engine. It would be months just to get a sprite to move across the screen. The triumph of a game would just be, oh, wow, it, you know, is 3D, or it has lighting.
Sure.
Like, that was a triumph.
Yeah.
And it still is to make that. It's a not trivial amount of work, but have an engine where all of that is included. I can drag and drop a box and have an entire physics engine. That is amazing.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of tools out there that also do that. I'm a big fan of Corona and LuaScript as well, but Unity is fast becoming just the standard of game development for both indies and AAA.
Yeah. So what's the easiest way to break into Unity? I mean, is it something that folks can watch your course and go to the download site, download it, and start making a game
today? It's a little tooting your own horn to say that, you know, this is the best way, but honestly, I think we put together a really good video start series.
Good.
And it's not an in-depth thing. It's only, I think, 8 hours of content, and it covers a lot of different things that you need for Unity development, but it's a really good start to dive in and start learning.
Yeah.
Personally, the way I learn is just getting sample code.
Yeah.
And Unity is also has an asset store built into it. So you can go online and find, hey, you need a specific function that does a specific thing. You need, you know, a lighting for God rays. You need a zombie asset. You need a city generator. They have that up on the store. Either upload it for free, or you could pay some other developer some amount of money and then get that included in your game. And Unity puts up for free a bunch of sample code, a bunch of fully completed sample games that you can download, look at, reverse engineer. And that's how I personally learn. Okay. There are also a lot of great books out there. Some of the names are fleeing me right now because I don't normally work with books.
You know, one of the things I like about Microsoft Virtual Academy is that you actually have people sitting there talking to you as opposed to, you know, trying to find the tutorial section or whatever and trying to get started yourself. You actually have people that take you right to the right place and just kind of hold your hand.
Yeah, that's what I like about video series. Like videos that aren't just holding your hand line by line of code, but saying, hey, here's an idea of the code. Hey, here's what this type of function does. Here's what this does. And then extrapolate out, here's what you can do with it. Just gives you the right seeds of like, okay, that's where I know I can look stuff up.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, in a college course, I think a good exam is open book. Because closed book exam is just about how much you can remember specifically. You know, if you ask me any question about the Unity API,
there's a good chance you won't know it.
I won't remember it.
But you know where to look.
Exactly. I know where to look, I know where to find it. And they make it really, really easy to find where to look, where to find it. And once you kind of know where you need to get set up, it is pretty quick to get started. I was actually in Denver, a few months ago for a Unity event there. And I met this kid, and I think he was like 13 years old, and he made at least half a dozen Unity games. And I'm not talking about like small bleeps and bloops, whatever, sample coding down. Yeah. Like, no, these were like full-on games that were amazing in quality.
And I met a couple of guys that were, they just kind of dived into game development. They dived into Unity. Mm-hmm. One of them was a sound designer, and the other one was the developer. And it basically took them about a year. And I thought that was good for me to have as a benchmark. If this is your road, if this is what you want to do, if you want to be an indie game developer in the 3D space, you dive into Unity, and a year later, you're going to be able to make a quality product. These two guys had a really quality product that they were just getting ready to release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just getting something working, you know, minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then however much polish there, you know, there's people who put 5+ years to do a game, but that doesn't mean that you have to put that much. It's whatever you need to get the quality, whatever experience you have. But if you have, especially if you have any kind of design experience at the time,
sure,
it helps a lot. If you've done any 3D modeling before, helps a lot in Unity, because Unity kind of operates very similarly to the way 3D modeling programs work.
Okay.
So I talked to some coders who've never touched like 3D art before, and they look at the interface and they think it's really confusing.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't look like Visual Studio at all.
Yeah.
But once you kind of get over that hurdle, and you know that depends on what experience you've had, how much time you put in, how much practice, it starts flowing really, really smoothly. It starts making a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Plus, we just released the Visual Studio tools for Unity, so you can actually use Visual Studio with Unity now, makes development a lot easier. You can do like debugging and everything that Visual Studio offers with Unity Project.
And then with the Unity, as well as the other game engines, it just feels like extra candy that when you're done with this game, you've got it on all the platforms.
Absolutely.
With a little bit of extra.
Cross-platform is core.
Yeah.
You need to be on as many platforms as possible. You need to be able to have a game that works on a desktop screen and a tablet and mobile and maybe a game console as well. And Unity lets you do all of those very easily.
I guess someday we'll probably look back and say, do you remember when we used to make a game one platform at a time, and if you wanted to work on another platform, you had to hire another team.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to dive in super platform-specific code anymore. Like, okay, let me take that back. It does make sense in certain scenarios.
Sure.
For gaming,
it
makes more sense to code as general as possible.
Yeah.
Because the wider the audience, the better, and people play on a variety of form factors. It isn't just a matter of tablet gaming is the only thing now. PC gaming, console gaming, that's still there. That's still a huge industry. But if you're just focusing on the desktop screen and you're not doing tablet, you're missing out on a lot of potential revenue.
Well, the interesting thing is I know there are differences between a big screen and a little screen in the gaming industry. I mean, if you look, for instance, at something like Halo as it runs on an Xbox versus Halo as it runs on the phone, it's very different because there's a different interaction. But for the most part, games are refreshingly different than content business apps in that they don't have a dependency, like as in from a design standpoint, they don't have a design dependency on the platform.
Yeah.
They don't care what the platform looks like because you usually just skin all your own buttons and anything.
Exactly. Like that. So if you know, it makes more sense if you're doing like an app type experience. You want to use the native controls. You want to have that. That's where a tool like Xamarin is really, really good. So you have a common code base,
yeah,
but still have that native code on top, get that native feel. But for games, it's all custom anyway. So what you really run into is control differences. Touch controls versus, you know, gamer controls versus keyboard controls. Mm-hmm. And that's where you'll get the most non-standard about it, because you'll have to customize it whatever your game may happen to be. And some games do it better than others. You know, some first-person shooters work pretty well on a tablet, many don't. Royal Time Strategies used to be a PC-only space, but you're seeing more and more of those on mobile platforms. Because
yeah,
they're
right.
kind of click-based games.
Right.
And touch and click are a very similar action. So,
and also the ability to easily pan and zoom with the tablet in front of you versus... I mean, I know we get used to the wheel on the mouse, but it's a little bit more natural.
Yeah, I mean, pinch is just as good as wheel in a lot of cases.
Sure is. Well, hey, I tell you what, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye to the audience, and I'm going to keep talking to Tobias because I don't get to catch up with him very often. So see you guys later, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you the next time on Code Chat.